Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, Howard. It is a pleasure to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. As we were talking before the break, I have a number of clients that I believe have used your program or are familiar with what it is you do. And so when you folks reached out and said, hey, perhaps we can be a guest on the podcast, I was sort of excited. And so we're going to talk about that. But before we do that, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Okay. Well, my name is Howard Gottlieb. I am the CEO and founder of Readathon Fundraising Company. I've been in the fundraising industry for about 18 years. Started out building what became the busiest product fundraising website in the country. It was called Easy Fundraising Ideas. During the first 12 years of that, we offered products to basically the underserved fundraising market that a typical product fundraising sales rep would not call on. Think churches, sports groups, school clubs, and the like. And we became very, very successful at it. But we kept hearing that schools were struggling with fundraising, that the typical way that they would raise money was by selling products that were getting very, very expensive. And they were the products, frankly, we were offering. So we set out to change school fundraising, and through an actual misstep, we developed a site called Chooseathon.com, which was early on in our web development days, and it was too broad in scope. But during those days, we bought a whole bunch of domains. Readathon was one of them.
Yeah.
And we spent 2 years, we had the luxury of spending time because we had a very good company in the fundraising industry. So we spent a full 2 years developing Readathon before we were willing to test the waters and see if the market would accept it and greet it. And frankly, what we deliver now, we're extraordinarily proud of. We've had schools in every state in America use us. We've had schools in seven countries use us. And it looks nothing like what I thought it would look like when we went to the drawing board, about 8 years ago.
So are you a fundraising guy at heart, or a private school guy, or where does your story sort of line up with this idea that you all started 8 years ago?
Okay. I am a lifelong entrepreneur. Readathon will be our seventh company we've either started or purchased. And after the sale of a company about 18 or 19 years ago, we were looking for something to do. It was the early days of the internet, and I realized that product fundraising was very broken up, regionalized, and dominated by local salespeople who couldn't possibly serve their market. So I didn't really have a technical background, but we built a website to serve that, what we thought was an underserved market, and it developed nicely. There was a huge market out there. In fact, at its peak, Easy Fundraising was getting about 10,000 unique viewers a day looking for fundraising products. So they were all coming to us.
So I have worked with a number of, as I shared with you before the before I hit the record button, I've worked with a number of private schools that do readathons. And we oftentimes incorporate the readathons into what we call their lane one sort of fundraising initiatives. And generally, I have been in private schools where they have enlisted hundreds, if not thousands, of perhaps. I think it usually involves parents and grandparents and neighbors and all that sort of mix of people, and can raise an extraordinary amount of money. Am I right?
Well, our top schools approach $100,000 in 2 weeks. Now, that's not typical, but those are the best schools, and they show the potential. And honestly, with all of the things that we see that we can add to the program, we think that that will be modest for a future upper-end target. We believe that reading is something that everyone in America would agree is a good thing for a child to do, and that most family and friends learning about a child focused on reading will gladly support that effort. So we're excited about the future.
So how do you all, when you talk to, because a lot of organizations these days, and especially in times like this where things are unpredictable and uncertain, organizations are looking for interesting ways and additional, creative ways to bring in additional revenue. But $100,000 isn't, you're not expecting that $100,000 initiative to necessarily grow to the point where it basically funds the operation, is my guess. Am I right?
Correct.
You want to see this become a part of a comprehensive development plan. Am I assuming that's accurate?
As far as the school's involvement and the money we raise as it goes and is used by the school, is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, most of the schools, for example, that we've done work with, our consulting firm has done work with, eventually arrive at the point where they're wanting to launch multi-million dollar capital campaigns.
Right.
And so a lot of the consulting work that I've historically done, Howard, is sort of connecting the dots between what happens during the readathon, the grandparent who contributes during the readathon, and sort of the relationship building process that happens subsequent to that. And then that capital campaign 5 years down the road that perhaps becomes successful because they were able to sort of see that continuum.
Right. I would think I would look at us more as a supplement to a major capital campaign. If you think about all the things that aren't covered in the primary school budget, either public or private schools, we fill in the gaps. We've had some small faith-based schools that have raised, $70,000 that have 60 students, and I'm sure that was an impactful number. But I don't think that we'll ever get to the point where we are the primary funding source for the school. We're just the supplementary, pay for the extras, give you a comfort zone. And in crazy times like we're in now, where school budgets are being cut and needs are greater than ever, that extra $30,000, $40,000, it can just be a lifesaver.
Right. So what does this look like? I mean, like I said, I have worked with, I'm thinking of a school that I worked with for several years, and they use the readathon every year. I want to say that it happened in October. I think it was maybe their signature blue sheets of little paper that I remember seeing every time I was on site around the same time. But what does a readathon look like? If it's playing out at the local school.
Okay. So if someone partners with us, it is not your grandparents' readathon. It is a fully modernized, digitalized readathon that we attempt to make all inclusive and actually get kids excited about reading as opposed to being burdened by keeping track of a lot of stuff. One of the things that we do differently than a typical readathon or walkathon or that sort of thing is we eliminated unit-based fundraisers. There are no pledges. We promote the child's participation in a focused reading project, and we ask for one-time lump sum donations. And over the years, through conversion optimization and a whole lot of A/B testing, our average donation is slightly over $35. Typically, where you know the events that you're talking about take a whole bunch of volunteers, we've packaged everything so that you and I could be running a readathon right now and not miss a beat in our life. The system does pretty much everything that you need for it to do. And in fact,
if I'm hearing this correctly, because the example I'm talking, I mean, it was a ridiculous amount of, and I'm not going to name any names, but they know who they are. I mean, it was a ridiculous number of blue sheets of paper that I remember one of the administrators had to work her way through. I'm guessing you're telling me that's not your program.
There is no paperwork with our program.
Okay.
All of the data for the system is, you know, accessed via our portal. It's done in real time. All the reporting on donations, on reading sessions, on everything involved, promotional tool usage is digital and real time. So someone can sit at their computer and, you know, actually watch donations come in, see who's participated, who hasn't. But there is no paperwork anymore. There's no record keeping.
Is Johnny, the little boy in second grade, for example, is Johnny actually carrying with him, for example, I have to imagine, is he carrying with him a sheet of paper or his mother's cell phone when he goes to knock on the neighbor's door and solicit support?
Okay, so there's no door knocking and no paperwork. So little Johnny's mother activates Johnny's page. And while she's activating it, we're going to ask the mother to help us out and be the first donor for Johnny.
Sure.
And then we're going to walk them through some crazy simple tools that we identify. We target grandparents first, and then we go out from there. And in about 3 or 4 minutes, using email, text, and social media, Johnny's mom can tell everyone she knows that Johnny's participating. So, you know, Johnny's mother's technically done in 3 minutes. Now, we try to get her more engaged as time goes on. But technically, all we need is Johnny's mom to focus for 3 minutes, and we will get donations.
Yes, I get that. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, the other thing that makes us different, too, as far as little Johnny goes, so you know, at every school, you've got this little superstar student who's going to outperform everybody, no matter what the deal is.
We'll call her Sally. Okay, right. We all know who Super Sally is.
Right. So Sally's going to succeed no matter what. Johnny, who's dyslexic, doesn't read, but he'll read for 30 minutes. Well, we happen to have a video on our homepage about a little girl named Claudia who is a dyslexic young girl, and she was the top fundraiser at her school in West Memphis, Arkansas, because of the encouragement that people said, you know, here's this student that doesn't outperform, but is working hard. And I really want to tell them how important reading is. So we get both ends of the spectrum, and I'm very, very proud of that. The Claudia story is one of those deals. The other thing that we're extraordinarily proud of, I don't know if it'll fit in anywhere else, so let me throw it in here, is we do log the number of minutes kids read on our portal, and it has now exceeded 2 billion minutes reading. So that just shows you that we do get kids excited about reading. They can win prizes. They can, get encouraging messages from friends and family. There's a lot of fun stuff that's happening, and it's easy. So we're really, really proud, which is, why I think we're such a relevant fundraiser for schools.
Yeah. So Howard, let me pull back a little bit on some of the training that we do, because I think this is perhaps one of the reasons I was excited about having this conversation. So I'm routinely talking about in our seminars, we teach what are called these three lanes. And the first lane is typically where we would see this this type of fundraising activity happening. And one of the things that I'm consistently saying is very consistent with what you described. I had no idea that's the way that the platform worked, but that we're going to increasingly see automation and online, a lot of these things that take up a large volume of people's time and resources, like these scraps of paper that I've seen at some of my client schools, are going to become much more automated. And with the capability of a group of volunteers, you're going to see some remarkable things, be pulled off with extraordinary efficiency. Is that essentially when you're talking to a prospective client, a school, is that essentially some of the tension that you have to navigate, that they've perhaps been doing something of this sort, and they have employees or volunteers who've been doing, they spend a lot of time doing that. All of a sudden, now you've got to, what are they going to do with that time?
Well, the objection we hear is we've always done X, so right. Therefore X must be good.
Yes, yes.
And X, might be okay, but if I could get you to monetize, improving reading skills at your school and either replicate or improve X, doesn't it make sense to try? And what we, the way we overcome the objection a lot of times is there's no cost to use us. We're basically a commission-only service. We get a piece of donation, so there's no risk. In fact, I have the risk because we do a lot of printing brochures that the school will send home to parents. So it costs me about $250 to let a school try me at no risk. So, and I'll tell you, our retention rate's upward of 90%. Once someone does it, they're startled at how easy it is. We've had schools going on 6 years. Their results don't diminish. And it becomes something that, becomes part of the school culture.
Yeah, yeah. I just see it's interesting to think, because I never would have connected the dots that Johnny and Sally didn't have to knock on the door. Did you see that? Did you sort of envision the non-necessity of that? I mean, you saw the non-necessity of that years ago, because obviously in a COVID state like we're in now, you can't be knocking on doors like that.
Right. So during Easy Fundraising's reign, we did well, but we knew that the burden was what you were doing in essence was you were asking Johnny and Sally to become salespeople for your store.
Yes.
And Johnny and Sally's mom, got sick of it, especially asking the neighbor to buy a 25-cent candy bar for $3. There was a lot of angst in the industry of ever rising prices and ever shrinking prices, participation rates were declining. So we said, heck, let's just get kids excited about reading. I mean, if we get you excited about reading and, hey, someone's going to get excited to support you, participation rates should skyrocket. So now, unlike other fundraising companies that are focused on their product and that sort of stuff, what we're focused on is we've got behavioral scientists and conversion optimization folks who are helping us create a better experience for the student and the parents to make it something that they care about. And if parents care and like what you're doing to raise money, you know it'll be more successful.
Does the one of the hangups I have about these sorts of initiatives sometimes is where the information goes. Howard, does the school get the benefit of the information behind each of these transactions?
Absolutely. They see everything happen in real time. And at the end of their fundraiser, once they signal to us, they've got to click a button that says end my readathon. 2 weeks later, they receive their money and we kill the database. So we don't store any data.
Do they have access to, for example, Aunt Susie's or Aunt Sally's, Sally's aunt's email address, so that the school can now use that email address for their own purposes?
Absolutely. Every piece of data they can download. But, you know, unlike other fundraisers, you know, like we're sending Sally's aunt a thank you note them. So we're, you know, now we're not building a donor base for them. But they could. That's a great idea.
That would be the and that's why that's part of what we try to. I may become one of your biggest fans, Howard. If I can help. So again, I'm going back to this lane one thing. I'm going to sell you on my lane one while you sell me on your readathon. Right. If organizations can see that they can subsidize, as you're describing, sort of create some sort of subsidy to fund some sort of fundraising goal, but that they can also build out their database, that to me is one of those overlooked opportunities that I think organizations don't see in a program like yours, is that they don't understand that, yes, in the near term, you're going to raise X number of dollars, $100,000, $200,000, but you're also capturing that information for which you can now build out a donor base and begin to build that comprehensive development plan that I think a lot of organizations totally forget about.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, I mean, that's a fabulous idea. And two, if we had an admin that thought like that, they would be so terribly successful with our program, because you're talking about on top of it fundraising admin at that point. If their vision is beyond the event, is what can I get out of this beyond the dollars and beyond the reading accolades? I mean, that would be terribly exciting.
Saying most of the time the client is not thinking beyond the $150,000 that they're going to raise.
No, but you've, I mean, you know, we are.
I mean, you and I should go on a roadshow, Howard.
Well, I'll tell you this. We hear good suggestions like that, and we will apply it. You know, we'll package it in some ending documents that here's the people who donated, you know, in descending order, their name, who they donated to, how much, and here's their contact. I mean, that's fabulous. That's a great piece of advice and a good suggestion. And if you think outside of the box, and we like to think we do, you know, it's stuff like that that make us different. In fact, I don't know if now, can I veer somewhere real quick?
Sure.
Okay.
We usually keep our listeners for about 35 minutes, and we've got about 12 more.
Okay. So one of the things we're working on now is we have a business donation system. So local businesses like, to look for the best advertising opportunity. Well, if everyone at your school is focused on your readathon website for about 4 weeks and your target is young families, we're fabulous. And our best schools can raise upwards of $10,000 with our current system, getting local business people. Well, we're bringing someone on board to look at national companies who want to advertise in advance for a readathon in specific zip codes, and we could look at demographics and all that sort of stuff. But our goal a year from now is to be able to go to every school in America and say, hey, use our readathon. I've already got $10,000 of advertising revenue lined up for you. So not only does it not cost you anything, you know, I've got all these people that want to reach your families, orthodontists, you know, real estate brokers, mortgage people, you know, car dealers, you know, just it's endless, the types of people who are trying to reach out to that demographic. So, I mean, to us, once we're out there selling that we've already got you $10,000, I mean, I think we get in every school in America.
Yeah. So what is the so tell me the story. So I want to hear more about the stories with the youngsters in the reading, because I've also been in education. Not only have I served a lot of these clients, but I think the stories that oftentimes are sometimes overlooked is that sort of joy of reading and that love of reading. So what are some of the outcomes that you're seeing on that side? We touched a little bit on that, but I want to make sure that that message gets driven home as well. I've got four children and I know how important it is to, at some point early in their up, you know, they've got to experience that joy of reading at some point. And I know these programs sometimes help with that.
So interestingly, the most touching stories that we get usually involve grandparents. And the student and the reader gets feedback from their sponsors. And to read some of the emails and messages that these grandparents leave, it's just heartwarming. I mean, how proud they are and gushy they are. And then we hear from the parents about how important that was for their student to hear that. And so, you know, we're creating excitement about reading. We're exciting, you know, creating family involvement. And interestingly, every grandparent in America wants to hear from their grandkids more than they do, most likely. There may be a few that don't, but I'll say that that's a pretty safe statement to make. So yeah, we actually give the kid a good reason to call grandma and grandpa and say, hey, grandma, grandpa, guess what I'm doing? You know, I'm participating in a readathon at my school and I want to send you a link, tell you all about it. So it gives them, you know, it's a feel good deal all over. There is, in our 8 years since development to today, we haven't heard anybody say really anything negative about the concept. Now, you know, there's been a few, you know, road bumps and burps systematically, yeah, and we've worked through those. But the concept is reading and for kids is a good thing. And if you can focus on it and make money, you know, man, you know, aren't you foolish to say, hey, we've always sold gift wrap, you know, hey, we've always done an auction. Well, maybe try reading. Because, you know, we like to tell people early on is we're way more than a fundraiser. You know, if we can get your kids excited about reading and you raise nothing, have you won or lost? You know, and if you've won, you know, that's fabulous. And if you get a check for $40,000 on top of it, I mean, you've won the lottery. So there's no downside. I mean, there's no cost, you know, upfront cost. So we love what we do. I mean, we love what we do.
So 90% of my listeners are fundraising professionals. Okay. And it's kind of like what we were talking about a few minutes ago about the sort of that resistance to change. Howard, I think some of the challenge that a guy like you and a guy like me has in this particular space is we have some fundraising professionals who, quite frankly, hide behind the status quo. And this is sort of that edgy point in the conversation as we're sort of winding down. But we have fundraisers, we have fundraising professionals. So these are people who are paid on the payroll to sort of maintain these overwhelming job descriptions that are heavily dependent upon volumes of transactions that are not automated and do not rely on, you know, improved technology and innovation and those sorts of things. And so it would be interesting to sort of hear how you have sort of navigated that, because I can tell you right now, we've got a development director at a small private school in Memphis, Tennessee or something that has run one of these programs that's not as streamlined as yours. But in some ways, his or her job description is sort of interwoven. Their professional identity is sort of interwoven with the volume of work that the way that's sort of the way that they've always done it. That's who they are. Do you follow my thinking?
I do. And so those people will not like me.
They usually don't like me either. And they
right. So, you know, even personally in the charities that corporately or personally I support, if a huge portion of it goes to fundraising costs, I really don't want to pay for you to raise money. I want to pay for you to feed the hungry. I want you to pay, you know, to get books in your library. I want you to use my money for something. So that's why we say, you know, you're not paying me anything. You know, unless I raise you, you know, the money you're looking for, you owe me nothing. And, you know, why don't you hire those fundraising professionals on the same basis? Is I'm going to pay you 5% of what you raise. Boy, you'd see a whole different industry out there. You know, you'd have people freaking out if they're only paid on their results versus, you know, their expertise or, you know, supposed expertise. For the schools that we help, you know, you were saying, well, the people are used to doing something. Think about the free time you now have, and you could better utilize your volunteers and better utilize your time to do things that benefit your kids instead of focused on, you know, this silly school fundraiser. You know, it just makes so much sense.
Yeah. So Howard, I got to tell you a story before I let you go. But I'm interested to hear if you've encountered and he's become a good friend. He's the head of school. He was the head of school. He's recently left and ended up in a much better place. But I was working with a school here on the Eastern Seaboard of the United States. I won't get too specific, but they had 19 when I arrived on the scene to help them clean up their overall fundraising operation. And generally, I'm making recommendations that they have four sort of annual initiatives that would generally include something like the readathon. So they would have the readathon, they would have the gala, the golf tournament, and something else, right? The Christmas letter or something. But there's basically these four sort of quarterly, four times a year initiatives. I got to tell you, Howard, they had 19 of these things. They had 19 of these things, and they weren't getting anywhere past that. So, you know, Grandpa John or Aunt Sally, who came to the gala or the golf tournament or whatever, and perhaps participated in the readathon, even if you were improving on it, for example, with making it as extraordinary as you've made it sound. They were also selling, you know, fruit and cookie dough and everything that they possibly could, but they were never generating margins adequate enough to sort of like make any of this really work. And I think that's what sort of most concerns me for the development directors out there, the fundraisers, who are my usual listeners here, who are sort of hiding behind these highly inefficient, what I call lane one strategies, very resistant to implementing a platform like yours. And eventually the boss or the board is going to sort of listen to a conversation like this and say, hey man, we can plug in a system like this and we might make your job all but irrelevant.
Absolutely. And you know, as well as I do, more in fundraising, meaning events, is never a good thing. If you're not successful with my readathon, drop me. You don't want to, you know, use me as one of 12. We tell schools two or three events max. One New York City school that uses us three times a year, and we're probably the only vendor they have that says, you're using me too much. You know, go down to two. And the three that they do are okay. But we're trying to tell them, do it once in the fall, do it once in the spring, and don't kill your people. Because they're going to, you know, people are going to grow weary. You know, if all you do is ask for money every week and you just change the way you're asking or, you know, what you want it for, at some point, you know, the well runs dry. So pick good events, pick the ones that get you the highest return, the lowest cost, the ease of operation, and focus on it. If I'm that, great. You know, if I'm not, we're great as well. You know, there's 140,000 schools in the U.S. alone, elementary schools in the U.S. alone. You know, our goal is to be in 100,000 of them. So we'll see.
Howard, I teach an entrepreneurship class over at the local college, and I got one itching question that my students over there would be interested. Was it automation or social media that you sort of saw coming on? Because one of those two had to be something that you sort of saw on the horizon when you started putting this concept together.
Right.
Or was it the combination of both or what?
Definitely the combination. The world was changing. The world is changing, and it's changing quickly. And if you don't stay ahead technologically, you know, you are dying. And I look at like the book fair industry as an example of a dinosaur.
Yeah.
You know, they're 90 years old. In fact, I won't name them, but one of the major book fair people just replaced their president in their book fair division with the ex-president of Barnes & Noble. Well, heck, I mean, you might as well go to the graveyard and pick your leader. Why don't you go to Amazon, you know, and get someone in their executive area that understands, you know, what the future. I mean, get the Sears president. You know, I mean, that's...
I worked at Sears. Howard, it's funny you mentioned. I worked at Sears when I was in college. Now, this was my wife and I've been married for 25 years, so I'm aging myself, but I was that last generation that got away with making really good money as a college student selling appliances. Right. And that was also before the internet really took off, but it was also before these big box stores like Best Buy and some of these other retailers came on. And you can't make the commissions like I made really good money in college, totally bunny trail here, but I made really good money selling, appliances on commission, Kenmore products, but that's not who we're going to for advice anymore. I mean, Sears is all but out of business.
Right. You couldn't replicate what you did back then. The world is different. And, you know, for your entrepreneurial group is you should look at where the puck is going, not where it is. You know, where are things moving to? And try to get ahead of it as opposed to necessarily looking at what your competitors are. You know, I don't know. That formula has worked well, but social media and technology are your friend.
Howard, I have really enjoyed this conversation. I was not aware of the program in its maturity. I really appreciate where you guys have taken this concept. I'm definitely going to be recommending people reach out to you. We'll put some information on our website and certainly in the show notes. But if somebody's interested in reaching out to you, having listened to our conversation today, how would you suggest that they do that?
Okay. If you're looking for general information, go to readathon.com. You could use hyphens or no hyphens, doesn't matter. Or if you want to reach out to me personally, my email is howard@readathon.com, but with hyphens. But there's a lot of information on our website. We make it as simple as possible to learn about us. There's nothing hidden, no hidden costs. And we would love to share everything about the company with anyone who wants to know about it.
Looking forward to meeting you in person at some point in the very near future. Howard, you're always welcome back here on the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you.
Jason, appreciate your time.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.